you need to validate a problem statement and not an idea. Like, I'm going to talk to 100 people in my target consumer base, right? And if 70% of those 100 people validate that this is a real pain point, I'm going to build this. So I think the number one mindset shift for me was to normalize embarrassment. Becoming so used to embarrassment that it doesn't shake you anymore. Because, you know,
comfort with discomfort.
Yeah.
Well, you are at HBS, so MBA. Yeah.
That's true. It teaches you a lot of things, but I think deciding and taking the plunge is not one of them.
I'm going to pause you. You know what the biggest joke used to be about HBS in my days? I think it's changed. They used to say HBS teaches you how to be a CEO. It never teaches you how to get there. Welcome to Unstarted. What is unique about this show is this is about you. It is for founders, by founders. Hi, my guest today on paper is actually quite intimidating. Columbia, Harvard Business School, strategy consultant. I happened to get to know her maybe a couple of years ago, and I can tell you that she's far from it. And one of the reasons is, as we will hear her own story, the background that she has grown up with and how she's carved out her life. So welcome, Neeja Bhatt, the founder of Lani. Lani is a company that I will let you describe how you came to and what the product lines are. But welcome and thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
So Neeja, Columbia, Harvard, what is the story that unites strategy consulting, waste management, now beauty? So let's go all the way back and bridge this together for us, especially since our audience, when they look at your kind of a profile, they meet founders, they're like, I don't think this can be me, whereas I think this can be them. So
super. I think I'm very much a duck on water, where you don't see all the legs shaking at the bottom. So I think in reality, the journey has been far from smooth sailing. So born and raised in Baroda, was raised by my Nana Nani. Mom was in the UN, so was posted all over, mainly Africa. Before Columbia, I was at USC. So Columbia was
so always... before we go there, so what was... Yeah. So you didn't want to travel with your mom, or it was for the education?
For the education and just having some kind of stability and continuity, because she used to be posted in a new country every couple of years. And I loved living with my Nana Nani. So I think that worked out. And I think a big part of just, you know, who I am and how I lead is to do with just being that small town girl inside. So yeah,
wouldn't
have it any other way. So Columbia was always the dream school. Actually did not get in. I got rejected from every school except USC, which was supposed to be my quote unquote safety school. Did very well at school.
You know what it stands for, right?
What does it stand
University
for?
University of...
Spoiled children. I've heard that. So went to USC. Always wanted to go to Columbia. That was the dream school. Didn't get in the first time. So went to USC. And actually, while I was at USC, made 3 trips to New York in spring break and Thanksgiving break. And actually befriended a professor there who I met. And he was doing this research, or planning to do this research, on urban green spaces.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, I'm very interested. Like, I want to do this research with you. But in order to do that, I need to be a student here, which I am not.
So urban green spaces, where did this interest come from? Or was it a path to Columbia?
The interest was in having a foot in that door. And I hope my professor is not watching this. Because he then very
100%
sweetly...
100%, we are going to send him the link. What do you think?
Because he very sweetly wrote me then like a letter that I could then send to the admissions committee.
Yeah.
That, you know, this girl is very interested in my research and I really want her in my team. And that's how I got
it. So jokes aside on USC, it's a great school. Yeah. LA is great. Why you know, this singular focus on Columbia?
Because that was the dream. And
how did that dream
check
come
that
about?
Box. I think it was a lot to do with just New York.
Yeah.
And of course, right, like when you're in high school, that Ivy League brand name feels more dazzling than it does now. I think you very quickly realize that there are far more important things and far more important factors to your success.
Yeah.
But when you're 17, you still care deeply about the brand.
Sure. So then strategy consulting?
Yes.
And then HBS.
Yes. So always knew, I think early on, that I wanted to do something of my own. But when I graduated, had neither the idea nor risk appetite. So strategy consulting was almost a non-committal career move. This was also during the peak of the COVID lockdown.
Yeah.
So I always saw it as kind of a way to park myself just for a year or
but
so.
But where did the original, you said you always saw yourself doing something of your own. Where did that come from?
I think it came from a very innate, almost personality trait or attribute, right? Where I knew that if I had ownership of something, I would move mountains to make that happen. If I didn't feel a sense of ownership for something, it was very black and white. Either I cared deeply or not at all.
Yeah.
And so I knew early on that, you know, starting something would be a good fit for that kind of attribute.
And with family and friends, was there a particular push in any direction?
Not really. So like I said, I grew up with my grandparents.
Yeah.
So we never really had, you know, like many people do, discussions of business or anything on the dining table. So I was quite immune from the world of entrepreneurship. I mean, again, right? Like I've never had an entrepreneur or someone who's gone through that 0-to-1 journey in my life that I've seen up close. So I think, again, like there was a part of me that just knew that, okay, if I had something of my own, almost like raising a child of my own, I would do anything to make it successful.
Super. So now you're at HBS, you're graduating. We'll take the first question, which will then take us to how you went about your next journey. Unsure how to begin. I currently don't have capital. I want to start my own business. I truly believe in it, but I have several ideas. Others have become successful businesses. Please suggest some practical and effective strategies. So it's Namrata Yogi. So here you are. You are clear you want to do something. Walk us through the rest of the journey.
Yeah. I think this is an interesting one because you, Avneesh, have seen me go through my full phase of analysis paralysis. I think at this point I've gone through.
Well, you are at HBS, so MBA.
That's true. It teaches you a lot of things, but I think deciding and taking the plunge is not one of them. So I think I've gone through at least 10 good ideas.
I want to pause you. You know what the biggest joke used to be about HBS in my days? I think it's changed. They used to say HBS teaches you how to be a CEO.
Uh-huh.
It never teaches you how to get there. So, yeah, so go ahead.
So went through at least 10 good ideas. I've actually sat in this office with 3 different ideas, brainstorming them with you, right? Something in ag tech, something in consumer tech. And there was kind of this like obsession with, okay, like what's that next big thing? So I think to this question, right, like I can speak from experience that the number one learning for me is you need to validate a problem statement and not an idea. I think it's very tempting to think in terms of idea that, okay, should I build this? The rule of thumb that really helped me get over this is, okay, I'm going to talk to 100 people in my target consumer base, right? And if 70% of those 100 people validate that this is a real pain point, I'm going to build this.
And that's for Lani?
That's for Lani, yes.
That's for Lani. So let's go back to
the previous
idea. Yeah, so you are still thinking.
Yeah.
You are in HBS taught analysis paralysis.
Yeah.
You can't figure it out. What did you do?
So yeah, right? Like, I mean, to your point, like HBS gives you all of these like models and like the lean frameworks, startup model and frameworks, and you can fit your idea. And invariably, you will find someone who will point out a loophole in your business model, and more likely than not, that someone will be you.
Yeah.
And so I think committing to an idea also takes some bit of delusional optimism.
Yeah.
That, okay, like I'm committed to this problem statement. I've identified something that is a very real pain point. This idea seems plausible, commercially viable. I'm going to take the plunge, and the idea will evolve into something that is successful, that is right for you, if the problem statement is right. So I would almost, the first step I would say is actually validating the problem statement, that if it is a very real pain point, don't overthink the idea.
Yeah.
Just kind of, you know, take the plunge. You will have an MVP, which is a minimum viable product. You'll test it out with people. People will give you feedback. Your idea will evolve. And in many cases, right, like what you launch is actually very different from the idea that you started with.
So you moved back to India though with something else, right?
I moved back with something else. So I joined Recove as well, initially the chief revenue officer and then co-founder, which was a waste management startup.
Waste management, beauty, very similar.
Yeah, complete 360. And again, like that also came from a place of, I thought joining a startup was better for me because I didn't have it in me to commit to an idea.
Yeah.
So it's taken, you know, whatever now, 2.5 years to kind of be like, okay, this is it. Now, come what may, I'm going to make this.
So happen. I think the instructive piece of this is, you know, she's talking about having a lot of ideas. Yeah. Everybody has a lot of ideas.
Correct.
There is a tendency to be wary of jumping into anything at all.
Yeah.
So I think the step one you did was you jumped in.
Yeah.
Turned out that wasn't the move that was going to work long term, but you moved back to India, you settled back in, got married, everything is, and then you went, and we'll come back to the customer validation.
Yeah.
But with your background, when you took this, you know, next step and jumped back in, what about fear of failure? What if it doesn't work? How did you think through that? What if my peers, especially with HBS in the first 5 years, what if my peers get ahead?
So I think the number one mindset shift for me was to normalize embarrassment, right? And especially when...
So you have to tell us your most embarrassing moment, right?
Yeah. You know, someone who's kind of like had a pretty linear, like, okay, dream school, dream job journey. I realized I'd never really set myself up to fail. And, you know, my professor told me this, that like, you know, it could be small things, right? Okay, sending a message on a group chat and being okay that, okay, no one's going to respond to you. Or signing up for something and knowing that, okay, no one is going to show up there. But just in micro ways, kind of becoming so used to embarrassment that it doesn't shake you anymore. Because, you know,
comfort with discomfort.
Yeah, because when you launch, there will be so many moments where, you know, someone doesn't like your product doesn't sell, you pitch to a VC and they don't like your idea.
Yeah.
So I think developing that thick skin
is a conscious non-negotiable moment.
Yes, 100%.
When?
And that, I think it came around the time when I got my first large check for this startup, right? When your mindset kind of shifts from, okay, will this work, to, okay, now I'm all in, like there's too much sunk cost, I have to make this work.
Yeah.
Where you have to be willing to, okay, go up to someone on an airport, be like, hey, like, you know, I saw you on TV, I know you are the promoter of this contract manufacturing.
That you were doing at HBS, you did that with me.
And did it with you. I've chased Avi down on campus for 3 minutes of his time at a coffee break. But yeah, so I think just normalizing...
No, but this is a very important... What you're saying, I think, is a very important thing. There's the analysis, there's the idea.
Yeah.
I think there are multiple things to unpack. First, you said, and we'll come to that, it's not the idea, it's a problem statement.
Yeah.
Ideas are to solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
Second, you said the first part of it all was to actually getting comfortable with discomfort, getting comfortable with embarrassment, being ready to put yourself out there.
Yeah.
So more than the idea, I think people need to be mindset shift, like you said. They need to be ready with that.
Yeah.
Right? And it's a conscious thing. It's just not automatic.
Yeah. And
right?
I didn't have it till I did. Like I have spent 2 years without that mindset and I just couldn't get myself to launch. So I think that is what changed for me.
So part of the analysis paralysis was because you were not ready for that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I think also more tangibly, right? And I know the question says that I didn't have the capital for it. I think that also played a big role for me. So it's also about just like financial risk aversion, right? And like not enough people talk about that.
But
starting your own business is A, the opportunity cost of your own time. Like out of HBS, I could have had like a pretty cushy job, which I now don't have. You don't have an income for many, many months or even years, while your peers, like you said, are thriving. It is a lot of personal investment that you put in, which is your personal savings. Like I didn't take any money from my parents, my in-laws, nobody.
Good.
I put my personal savings from my consulting days into this. So I think just being at peace with that kind of risk appetite is also something that you kind of have to teach yourself, like
but that's great. You are saying you taught yourself, because a lot of people would think entrepreneurs are born risk taking, you're either born with or not. That's not the case.
No. Like, I didn't sleep at night the day I wrote my first, like, big branding check.
Yeah.
Because I had never spent so much of my own money and truly betting on myself, right? It's this could be 0-0 in maybe, like, a few months.
And that therein lies to me when people worry about failure. I think the thing to think about it is, to worry about that, will you not bet on yourself?
Yeah.
You have to bet on yourself.
Yeah.
Otherwise, frankly, I think there are many more and deeper failures in life. Let's go to the second question, because now you have taken the plunge, you have moved to India, you have joined a business to try to learn in it. We'll talk about how you reached the conclusion that that was not right for you.
Yeah.
And then let's answer this question on, because you said it's about problems and not ideas.
Yeah.
Let's take this question.
Hi, my question is, how do you land up on the unique problem that you decide to solve for? Is it just passion? Is it market gap? Or is it a mix of both? Thank you.
So waste management to where you are. What was that journey?
So waste management, of course, was not my idea. I joined someone else's idea. I think with Lani, I found myself going back to a personally felt pain point, right? I mean, we are a personal care brand for women, and these are basically products that I wish existed. In fact, a deodorant is, you know, I've given at least 5 people this idea that, hey, like, please create a deodorant brand in India because I could really use one. And as a country, right? I mean, like, our food, our climate, we are also genetically predisposed to bad body odor. Yeah. And it's just something no one talks about. And in many ways, deodorant has been a largely masculine category, right? Like, you see your Axe and your Fog. Women's lifestyles have evolved, right? Like, women are leading more active lifestyles now. Women are working out. Women are spending long days at work. But this, there are certain parts of the beauty and personal care space, which I like to call like the underbelly of the BPC industry, right? Like body hair removal, odor and sweat control, that
so how did you
left behind.
So was it then macro, I'm going to do BPC and then here's the problem statement, or it was this is the problem statement?
This is the problem statement, and it happens to be in BPC. And you know, to the question, I don't think passion is a prerequisite, or relating to the problem is a prerequisite to building, but it sure really helps, because I think when, you know, shit hits the fan, and that happens all the time, or you're feeling demotivated that, you know, what am I doing? Like, is this the right thing? It is your passion, your ability to relate to the problem that kind of lifts you up and like helps you fight another day.
So you can say it's not a prerequisite. I say it's a prerequisite.
You think it's a prerequisite. Yeah. That's my thought.
You lived experience to your point.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to go in the direction you expect it to.
Yeah.
You have to be able to so relate to the problem that you can get through those stuff.
Fair enough. Unless you have like a, unless you have a comparative advantage in a sector, right? Yeah. Where you may not be passionate, you may not relate, but you have some kind of unique access or skill set that relates to that sector. But fair enough. I think market gap is more of a prerequisite, right?
Very
because
good.
I have seen enough founders kind of build out of passion, but not with the market gap. Anecdotally, I think the reverse is still more likely to be successful. But that's just, again, like,
it's very good. I was just with a founder earlier where this was phrased differently, but it's a theme, which is, where do you play?
Yeah.
Not how you play.
Yeah.
Sounds like not lived experience, but very relatable problem for you. And then you picked a market gap or where to play. So talk more about that.
Yeah.
And talk more about how did you validate that you were talking about speaking to customers.
Fair enough. Because I also believe that when you, you know, relate to the problem, it's even more important to validate the market gap, because it's very easy to be kind of biased by what you or your echo chamber around you believes in, right? Like a very interesting statistic, like at this one point I was trying to build like this sugar-free beverage, and a VC friend of mine told me that, do you know that Diet Coke sales are 1% of regular Coke sales, even though you feel, okay, everyone around me is drinking
because
Diet
you're the 1%.
So it's like the next big thing. So I think validation becomes even more important. So what I did was, honestly, and I've been blown away in this process by just people's generosity to just talk to you, right? So I was a part of a lot of these WhatsApp communities and Instagram communities and certain Reddit communities. But I just said, hey, like, you know, I am building this brand and I want 30 minutes to hear about your morning personal and body care routines. And nearly 200 women like signed up to have that 30-minute conversation, no incentive. And I was like, just tell me, like, tell me what products you use, tell me what's working, tell me what's not working, how long have you used this product, like, what went into this decision.
These communities, did you join for this purpose or you were
so
already
So some of
in
them I was already on part of because, again, like, I am in many ways my TG.
Yeah.
So some of them I already was on. Some of them I joined just to kind of expand the reach. But I think you'd be surprised at just... people, when there is a problem that people kind of feel deeply, people are very willing to help and share and very openly. Like even today we do focus groups. We just wrapped up a focus group where 25 women came on like a random weekday after their office, some from Vikhroli, some from Andheri, all the way to Worli, and spent 2 hours with us just chatting about like, okay, what's the next product they want to see.
So came... some lived experience, lot of outside in work, and now you're about to pick a product. So let's ask the product question.
Hello, sir. My name is Pallavi.
And I'm Abhijit. We are the founders of Gubachi, which is an India-inspired kids toy brand.
We're at a scaling stage currently. And at this stage, we're facing a tension that we're sure a lot of D2C founders face. So far, our North Star has always been to introduce unique toy concepts. Concepts that bring to life our brand story, have the scope of establishing an emotional connection, build a storytelling platform. For example, these Madhubani block art puzzles, which are inspired by the Madhubani art form of India, right? These are one of a kind in the market. Now, these of course come at an innovation R&D tax and also have a longer education curve for the customer.
But on the flip side, what we've noticed is that there's a lot of massive consumer traction for standard category staples such as this, such as Dominoes or Jenga, something that the customer knows, something that the customer is very familiar with. And therefore, there's very high velocity, a lot of demand for such products. But on the flip side, it doesn't really have a brand story. There's no scope for you to create any USP, no differentiation. It's very, very standard stuff. But a whole lot of volumes get sold, stuff like this.
So basically our dilemma at this point is, should we lean into these standard products and use them as the revenue engine to drive innovation for us? Or does diluting our catalog with these standard commodity-like products actually end up diluting the brand premium that we are trying so hard to build?
Amazing question. I have no clue on the answer, but I'll let you start.
No, I think that's a great question and something that the team discuss all the time, right? And I mean, so we're in the body and personal care space. So here's my take, right? I'm in no position to give gyan to anyone. As you know, we're pre-launch. But at least this is my thinking on this, that the two are not mutually exclusive. I think for every brand, you have certain hero products, which are the products that your brand is known for and the products that people talk about. But you do, like, especially in D2C, right? AOV is kind of at the pinnacle of your unit economics, right? You need to drive up that order value in order to kind of, break even to make a profit. And so what often happens is you have to kind of make these filler products, right? Like in our industry, for example, like we're launching our clear deodorant stick, which is something we've worked on for 8 months and very novel formula, all of that. Something like a shower gel, right? Like there's a limit to how much you can differentiate on a shower gel. Like, okay, fragrance, packaging, all of that. But you need to sometimes complete your category because A, like you said, like that's easy revenue. These are add-on products. You know, people are checking out. It's just something that they can add to increase your order value. And at the same time, there is value in kind of being a one-stop shop, right? Like there's that cart effect. Like people like going to a brand where they know, okay, all their needs for a category can be met in one place. So I would think it's not mutually exclusive. I would say, and something that we are very conscious about, is it's very important to be distinctive about what is your hero product and what is not. If it's not your hero product, it's tempting to kind of exaggerate the claims and make it sound like this superstar product. That's when you start losing your brand equity, and then that trickles down to your other products as well.
Yeah.
Because if someone buys your product, which is a standard product, good quality, but it's not like you have kind of reinvented the wheel or, you know, the magic wand created this amazing product. People will try it. You would have overpromised and under-delivered, and that person is probably never going to buy your hero product again.
Brilliant, brilliant. So, but let's unpack that a little bit more, and then I'll summarize my views. So, your clear deodorant, where would it be priced versus your competition, or what would be? Is it similar or higher?
So, we are going to retail for $7.95.
Yeah.
Our mass market alternatives, just by the gram, would be somewhere in that 400, 300.
So, your mass premium, let's say 40-50%.
Correct.
Your, and it will promise better efficacy of some sort. Your shower gel will be priced how compared to your competition?
So it would still be at a premium to mass market, because again, right, like the in this kind of model, the brand is the premium.
Yeah.
And so this is still in the pipeline, but we would then price it at maybe like 20-30% higher than
but not promise crazy efficacy or anything.
No.
I think it's a brilliant answer, and to answer this, my view is exactly the same. I don't think it's either or. I do think you have to play in categories that are the acquisition categories. One thought for this question for them, because I think you are doing it, and I love the fact that you are saying then don't overpromise. My view is don't even price it too high, by the way. The shower gel, let it be. I do think the completion of the category, the completion of the SKUs is important. People will search for your brand. You are spending on acquisition. I think what they could do is the commoditized stuff like Domino's or Ludo, they can potentially pack the Domino's in a Madhubani kind of pack.
Yeah.
Right? So they are, so it should not be two completely different brands.
Sure.
Packaging should be consistent. Do something that feeds on each other.
Yeah.
It's a commodity product, but it looks like Madhubani paintings or the Ludo board has something like that, and therefore you have brand synergies.
Yeah.
But in a market, to your point on where the one is where the market gap is, but second is where the market is moving.
Yeah.
You have to be. And there's a framework you can look up. I'm happy to give credit to one of our US peers, well-respected firm called Sequoia Capital. They have a framework, and if you search Hair on Fire, Sequoia Capital, you'll get this framework. And essentially it categorizes the different types of markets. And if there's something that is moving that's called hair and fire, it will tend to get commoditized. But you can't afford not to be in it.
Sure.
So my view is you find a way of marrying the two. But great, great
and
answer.
To your point of acquisition, right, that often like when your product is almost too innovative, it can also be intimidating for someone to kind of buy that for the first time.
Correct.
So it's important to have these entry points into your brand
so that
kind
they
of
get
comfortable.
You,
dip their toes.
Very good. So now idea is also there. Now we keep, although the question is not here, but we keep getting from founders, should I raise money, should I not raise money, should I get product market fit first? You have raised money without a product. So how did you think about it, and where do we go from here?
Yeah, so we got a lot of, I think a lot of people had a lot of strong opinions on this when I was thinking about to raise or not to raise.
I didn't, of course.
You didn't, of course. I will say I'm very happy that we raised. It's too soon to tell. But I think it's less a strategy thing, more a personality thing. I am someone who is more financially risk averse. And I felt like we were in a category like personal care where we couldn't afford to take it slow. Like we had to go all in. We had a solid product. We had an edge in terms of, an innovative product. We knew that it would take maybe 4 or 5 months for a competitor to come and replicate this and beat us with their marketing. So we had to go in like all bells ringing, like influencer marketing, performance marketing. And that takes a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I found my own personal risk aversion financially clouding my judgment on like what's right for the brand, right? Like when you have to cut that check for like 5 lakhs for an influencer to post about your product.
Yeah.
It's not easy. And so we did end up raising, and I think I'm a better founder for it. Like I'm now no longer operating from that place of constant fear.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm still very invested. I mean, my personal wealth is still very linked to the brand. There's no question about that. But at least it doesn't keep me up at night. Like I experiment more. I'm willing to be more bold with, you know, how we approach the go-to-market. I would also say there's a huge opportunity cost of your time. And this is something that I've learned backwards, right? That raising is like a full-time job. I have chronic acidity from all the coffee chats that I did 4 times a day with VCs. Especially if you're a solo founder, like for people who raise right after they launch, I think you'd rather be doing a lot of other more pressing things. So I'm glad to have gotten that out of the way. Maybe you could tell me if it matters in terms of valuation to raise pre-launch or right after launch.
I told you to raise less because not dilute too much. But see, I do think it's the right decision for you. It is all context specific.
Now,
you have confidence in your product market fit.
Mm.
You have that confidence, A, because of lived experience, but B, because you have done the consumer research. You're still doing the consumer research. I'm assuming you've done the tests and all that.
Yeah.
So yes, people would copy you very fast. So when you are unclear about product market fit and will take iterations, the money just creates pressure and it makes you potentially make wrong decisions and make wrong choices. When you're clear that the product market fit will happen, yes, somebody will copy it very quickly. And then, so I think you're doing the right thing. Obviously, the key to watch then is that frugality culture, all of that, you know, efficiency has to still remain in place.
Yeah.
Right. So, super. So, Neerja, audience is listening, watching. Many of them are aspiring entrepreneurs. You have gone through your journey of trying to figure it out. From your vantage point today, what's the advice?
Oof, I don't think I'm qualified to give advice by a large margin. But I think if I were to like just sum up everything that I have learned in the last 2 years, right, is I think all it takes is just the ability to keep the momentum going and to eat a lot of shit. So bring a large appetite and to kind of it's natural selection, right? Like who is going to keep taking the punches and keep going even when things go wrong? And I believe that if you're at it long enough, I think success is inevitable.
So I told you that I always call out one trait of each founder that I think differentiates them. And after this last piece, I don't think I need to call it out. It's persistence, it's relentlessness. So Godspeed on the journey ahead, and thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
Cheers. You're watching Z47 Moments, the podcast by India's oldest venture capital firm, Z47. If you like this episode, consider hitting the subscribe button and the bell icon so you never miss an update from Z47 Moments.